Well, good afternoon to all of you. We go back to the gray, to the real world of forecast errors after this nice talk. And I'm actually going to present here some work we did on the wind power forecasting with emphasis on meteorological forecasting in Croatia in collaborative project between several institutions. This is the Met Service from Croatia, the Faculty of Electrical Engineering and Computing, the Croatian TSO, the Energy Institute, and one private company. Now, Croatia is here, so it just you can see it on the map, just across Italy. If you cross the Adriatic Sea, as many Italians do in summer, you enter Croatia. Currently, our installations are quite low. It's 16 wind power plants, but in 2014, we had 4.5% of electricity consumption from wind. And there are a lot of plans for new installations that are denoted here in black colors, mainly along the coast. And the plan is to triple installations by in the next 5 years. Now, before I go on, I have to say a few words about the specific challenges we are facing in Croatia. We have really available ample resource, but there are a few challenges. One of them is the complexity of the terrain. So as you can see on this map here, this is Croatia here, we are surrounded by the P-shaped mountains. So there are Apennines, Alps, and Dinaric Alps. So Apennines here, Alps here, and Dinaric Alps. And the coastal terrain, the coastal area, which is the area of the highest resource, is just in between. Now, the terrain gives rise to some specific phenomena, and these are severe downslope windstorms, or Bora winds, and they are very frequent during the cold season. As you can see here, this is one of the typical wind rows in Croatia, and the measured 10-minute wind speeds reach 40 meters per second. So every time there is a northeasterly flow over the continent, the winds really the wind speeds up on the lee sides of the mountains here. What does it mean to the winds actually in the region? So this is, you can see the four stations on the range of 20 kilometers. The scale is the same. It goes from 0 to 30 meters per second. And you can see quite a bit of variability there, including some large ramps. So typical ramps in Croatia, for example, you can see on the lower slide here, it's about 20 meters per second in 10 to 20 minutes. So this happens quite frequently. Now, if we zoom in into this very small area, we can see measurements which are 400 meters apart on two sides of the bridge. And you can see that the wind speed, which is in blue, differs for more than 20 meters per second, and that the maximum gust differs for around 30 meters per second. These are the sustained differences over an entire day. So it's not instantaneous difference. Now, if you go to temporal variability, Bora is extremely gusty, turbulent wind. So we have gusts of on Hurricane 5 scale reaching 69 meters per second. Due to turbulence, we have high wind hysteresis, and some studies show that there is a loss of 6 to 10% of annual energy production due to turbulence. The characteristic turbulence exceeds class S standards, as you can see on the upper slide. So this is the class, it's a bit hard to point with this. This is the class A wind turbine standard, and this is the characteristic turbulence for winds in Croatia. And you can see here on the lower slide a 10-minute sample of data. So the red is the 10-minute average, it's constant. And you can see that there is a lot of variability going on around there. We have ramps for, in this 10-minute period, which is selected just as one of the 10-minute periods during Bora events, ramps of 44 meters per second in 20 seconds. So this is really huge. So Bora is really an extreme wind. It's challenging to measure, simulate, predict, or from the wind energy perspective, manage and control. Now, how to deal with such wind regime? It's a challenge we face every day. And we believe that the very high-resolution NWP models are essential to do that. And we use the mesoscale model Aladdin coupled to global models. And the question is, how much do you need to refine? And we actually did a study which used the available observations. And there is a method how you can derive the ratio of the observed and modeled variability of wind in different spectral frequency ranges. And this study here shows the entire spectral range. You can do this for diurnal flows or any other flows. And it sees that that actually what we believe is that we need to go down to 1 kilometer grid spacing to properly represent wind variability, in this case at 10 at 50 meters level. So we do this in a way as far as we can. We used our baseline model at 8 kilometer grid spacing with data assimilation, and then we have two versions of the 2 kilometer NWP model. One is called dynamical adaptation. It's basically a simplified mesoscale model developed by Mark Jagger, who is sitting around here, which we use for several years already in operations. And the other is just the full physics regular mesoscale model at 2 kilometer grid spacing. Now, if you take a look at the distributions, this becomes really clear that it's very important. Here in blue, you can see the measured wind distribution. You can see here it has a long, long tail. So there is around 5% of winds over 19 meters per second. Now, the yellow one is the 8 kilometer run, and it actually doesn't have any frequencies above 12 meters per second. The dynamical adaptation, which is in green, really does a nice job, but still underestimates the long, long tail on the right-hand side. And the full physics runs does a little bit better. Now, if you compare the root mean square errors in the coastal and the flat terrain here, you can see that basically the root mean square error is reduced from 8 to 2 kilometers in the coastal terrain due to better resolution of the surrounding terrain. But the 2 kilometer grid models just don't differ that much, don't differ significantly. And in flat terrain, actually, all three models don't differ very much. And I'm going to come back to this later on. Now, the second thing is that we verified models on the wind tower locations, and on some of them we still have huge biases. This is a bias of around 30%. This is the multiplicative bias, and these are the wind towers denoted 1, 2, 4, 5, 8. And to improve the basic the challenge was here to develop or test a post-processing method that will not reduce the intensity and the frequency of the strongest winds. And for that, we collaborated with Luca Delle Monache here, tested a couple of methods, including Kalman filter, analog ensemble, and a hybrid approach with both of them. And you can see here the improvement. This is on 16 stations in Croatia. So there are 8 of them in coastal terrain, some of them in mountain and flat terrain. This is improvement in terms of percent. So root mean square error in coastal terrain, which is the most interesting for wind energy applications, goes around 10%. The rank correlation coefficient is improved for 20% and bias for around 40%, which is great. Now, what we want to check is how does it perform for strong winds, really strong winds. So this is the critical success index, which actually is sensitive to the not only to the fact that if you simulate strong wind speed, but to the fact that you have to simulate it at the right time. So these are for winds higher than 19 percentile for on both sides. And these are the two towers, tower one and tower two. You can see that here the Kalman filter and the three versions of the analog methods, they work pretty well, actually. And gray is the dynamical model at 2 kilometer resolution. The other tower is not so great, but it seems that post-processing methods can really help with the strongest winds. Now, on this slide, you can see that 8 stations and 10-meter level in coastal terrain. And here you have three models. This is the 8-kilometer model, this is the 2-kilometer full physics model, and this is dynamical adaptation at 2 kilometers. And then all of the post-processing methods apply to these models. So again, the Kalman filter, the analog ensemble mean, then the combination of Kalman filter and analogs in two versions. And you can see that while the post-processing methods really improve the 8-kilometer model resolution, the improvement over 2-kilometer model resolution is quite moderate, but it still exists. So there might be some limitation regarding the application of post-processing methods on the very high resolution models, and we're going to come back to that as well. We also tested the analogs on the for the uncertainties. I show here just the reliability diagram, which shows comparison of analog ensemble and logical regression, and the analogs really seem to work well with this respect. So finally, what we did is we tested also methods for short-range wind power forecasting. One is the WPPT software, which was purchased by TSO, and the second one is what we developed. It's a multi-layer neural network using the information theoretic learning criteria. The benefit of this criteria is that it doesn't make assumption on the Gaussian distribution of the errors. So basically, they do compare pretty well, although there are large differences in the training periods around here. So what you can see here is that occasionally large, huge errors occur in the system, and this is our interest so far. But before that, the fourth component we developed is the nowcasting and ultra-short-range forecasting. We tested several methods depending on the fact that are we interested in the wind nowcasting, on wind power nowcasting, based on neural network approach, and also on the autoregression exogenous methods. You can see that basically this is the forecast lead time. This is the mean absolute error. The lead time goes from 0 to 180 in 10 minutes intervals. So you can see that basically there is quite a bit of improvement over persistence if using the neural networks or these autoregression models. So I want to say, use the last few minutes and show you a little bit of the, let's say, intelligence about the model errors. So we've seen from this presentation and also many publications that at high resolutions, the root mean square error often does not decrease with increasing the model resolution when you go down to resolutions of a few kilometers. And we know that the root mean square error is really sensitive to large errors as well as double penalty errors. This is just one example of different forecasts, valid for the same time but at different forecast ranges. And you can imagine one is much closer to observation. So we know that in this area where there is a small shift in time or in space, we have large root mean square errors or other sorts of errors. And these errors are really one that contaminate the scores. So we wanted to take a look a little bit more deeper into that, and we actually did a root mean square error decomposition, which can be decomposed to bias of the mean, bias of the standard deviation, and so-called dispersion error. And this dispersion error is actually the error which reflects, I'm sorry, it's a little bit hard to see, this dispersion error really reflects the loss of coherence, loss of spatial temporal coherence between model fields and the observed fields or weather. And the second thing we wanted to do is we wanted to use a spectral decomposition, which is kind of tolerant to phase errors, to better understand the sources of errors. So you can see here the classical power spectral density functions in terms of period. This is the diurnal periods, these are the synoptic periods, and these are the subdiurnal periods here. This is the power spectral density for several models and observations. And actually, it can go quantitative, so not only to compare visually, but you can select ranges for analysis, and you just integrate these power spectral density functions, and you get contribution of diurnal flows to the total wind variability, for example, as a number. And then you can compare this with your models. So first, about the decomposition, which was done on 16 stations at 18 coastal stations, we have three graphs here. The top one is 8-kilometer model. The middle one is dynamical adaptation at 2-kilometer model. And the bottom one is the full physics model at 2 kilometers. So to make it easier for you, the red, these are the stations on the x-axis. So these are the old stations. The red denoted, the red arrows are the stations in the coastal terrain, and the black is the stations in the flat terrain. So what we can see in that in flat terrain, and the root mean square error, which is in blue, actually corresponds very well to these dispersion errors, while biases are small. So bias of the mean and bias of the standard deviation are small. So in flat terrain, the root mean square error is composed entirely or almost entirely of these phase errors. This dispersion error, so, well, dispersion of phase error, I'm using these terms interchangeably, so it's really the dominant source of error. Now, if you go to high resolution, you can see, sorry, before we go that, if you check the coastal terrain here, you can see that all three sources of errors really contribute heavily to the root mean square error. Now, if you go to high resolution models, you can see that the biases are really reduced also in coastal terrain, and the dispersion error, which is in green, really corresponds quite well to the root mean square error, which is in blue. This suggests that while we get rid of the biases, there is the largest error remains the dispersion error, which is, say again, just the inconsistency, could be a very small inconsistency in time and space between the models and the observed atmospheric state. So the final idea from this is that dispersion error is not reduced when increasing the grid spacing, or it's in flat terrain, or that it's pretty constant at 2 kilometer grid spacing, regardless of the model complexity. And that basically, at these resolutions, model dispersion error remains the main source of root-mean square error. Now, so the further reduction of root-mean square errors, if you are looking for that, you will have to tackle dispersion errors. That's the bottom line of this. So we have several other questions. Are dispersion errors related to certain scales of motions? For example, longer than diurnal motions. It could be some errors coming from the lateral boundary conditions and propagating to the model, making small time-space errors. Or it could be the sea breeze, which is not happening at the right place at the right time or something like that. Or it's subdiurnal motions. And the second question we ask ourselves is, how are statistical and spectral errors related? So basically what we want to do is we want to get hints from the spectral analysis, which is physically based analysis. It gives us some idea of how well the model represents certain scales of motions. We want to see how this reflects on the statistical errors. So you can see this a bit on this slide. There are two groups of coastal stations we are looking for. We are analyzing. This is the thermal group, so a group with strong diurnal flows. And there is this downslope windstorm group, which has strong downslope windstorms. So you can see here first comparing these two groups. Now, there are four stations in each group. And if you actually kind of blur your eyes, you can see that there are some differences between thermal stations and the Bora-dominated stations. On the x-axis, I forgot to say that.
Sorry, 1 minute.
Okay, thank you. On the x-axis, you have actually increasing share of longer than diurnal energy in the total energy variability. And on the y-axis, you have the phase errors. So you can see that as the energy of synoptic motions generally is increased, the phase error is reduced. This kind of makes sense because the synoptic motions are really slowly evolving. So you are going to not have too many of these errors in space and time. And it's similar for a diurnal range and subdiurnal range, which are shown on the graphs below, that the phase error increases with the increased share of diurnal or subdiurnal flows in the total energy variability. Now, if you take a look at the variability between these two groups of stations, so you can see with Bora flows that there is a very clear, sharp decrease of phase errors as the synoptic energy becomes larger. And this is what makes sense. And as well on the bottom slide, the phase error really increases as the share of subdiurnal motions increases very much. But for thermal flows, it's actually not really like that. What you can see from the upper slide is that there is a hint that actually with thermal flows, the phase errors increase with increase of synoptic energy on the station. And you can see on the middle slide that actually the phase errors are insensitive to the amount of the diurnal flows. I'm talking about these thermal flows, so these four stations around here. So this is a kind of non-intuitive, and we wanted to double check it. And you can see here the same graph.
Sorry,
so
you have to conclusion.
I'm finishing, thank you. This is on the y-axis, you can again see the lower than the diurnal share of energy in total energy variability of the wind. And on the y-axis, you can see the phase error contribution to the root-mean square error. And you can see in yellow, in green, that it really increases with the synoptic energy, which suggests to us that we should look for errors in actually interaction of the synoptic and diurnal flows. Because we've seen that the error is not related, the phase error is not related to diurnal flows, so there must be something related to interaction of synoptic and diurnal flows, and we know this interaction. direction makes a lot of effects on the timing, for example, of the diurnal flows. So we are going to look into our data and search for these kind of errors and try to analyze more what's really going on in the model. I'm going to skip this slide and conclude. I'll leave some time for questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.